like that steady day-to-day, pack the kiln, unpack the kiln, glaze, dip everything, put it back in the kiln. There is an element of pleasure from repeatability, and producing fine work that is monetarily accessible to the public.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, and I'm pleased to share my conversation with Mark Daly from Stratfordshire, England in the UK with you today. Mark's initial training was in textiles at Stratfordshire University, and then he got bit by the clay bug and progressed into ceramics. After he achieved his MA in ceramics, he set up his own studio and has been applying his love of surface pattern to ceramics ever since. His inspiration comes from 17th century Stratfordshire slip trailing, mid-century Stoke-on-Trent industrial ceramics, and the sci-fi anachronisms of the 1940s and 50s animations and comics. Wow, what a combination. He hand-builds, casts, and throws his work, and his black and white ware is done with high-fired white earthenware. He and I talked about his techniques, where he uses slip trailing, paper resists, layering with slip dots, drips, and line work. He also applies platinum and gold luster in a third firing to handles and knobs, particularly in his sculptural work. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and you can find out where to connect with him in the show notes, and you can find all the information at colorandceramics.com.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Mark, welcome to the Color and Ceramics podcast to talk about color and surface decoration. I'm really excited to have you here today.
Well, it's good to be here, and thank you for asking me.
Oh, you're most welcome. You know, I've followed you for some time on social media because I really love your work, the black designs primarily that you use on your white clay body. And I'm also really enamored with the gold and silver, and I see a little bit of other bright colors in there because I think that really makes your work pop. So I'm really looking forward to talking about your work and color and surface design and sort of how you think about things.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, awesome. So obviously, since your work is so exquisite, this has taken you a little while to get to this. It's not like you started this yesterday. So I wondered if you could tell our audience a little bit about your journey in clay, what you've been doing to get you here today.
Yeah, sure. So I came to ceramics in a very kind of non-traditional, indirect way. I did a foundation year in general art design for a year when I was 18 in Salisbury, the fantastic cathedral city in Wiltshire in England. And I fell in love with being creative, mark making, drawing, and then I progressed on to a BA, a Bachelor of Arts degree course. I think you could undergraduate. And I studied textile design for 3 years. So I was, again, doing life drawing three times a week. There's a lot of, I think it's been slightly lost, I think, in current art college, art course environments, that computers have become so prevalent that sometimes I think the pen, the pencil and paper, the charcoal and paper has kind of been sidelined a little. But when I was doing my BA in the 1980s, drawing was a very strong element of that. So I had a good foundation in graphic representation, graphic design, pattern making, repeat patterns. My designs were really very, very colourful. I was sort of influenced by the current music of the time, the late 70s, punk rock, fluorescent colours. There was a sort of dynamism. You can edit that bit out. There was a sort of dynamism about that time. And it was infectious. And so my work had a lot of energy to it. Then, after completing that, I got a first class degree, honours. And I progressed on to, strangely enough, I tried to apply for the Royal College of Art in London. Didn't get in. I didn't get into the MA in textiles in Manchester. And then I was somebody said to me in passing, why don't you try ceramics? And I think again, that I wanted to carry on creating in a sort of academic environment. So I started the MA in ceramics at what was then at North Staffs Polytechnic, which now Staffordshire University, which is in Stoke-on-Trent. And I'm sure probably many of your listeners will know that Stoke-on-Trent for centuries has been the sort of epitome of industrial ceramic production in England, and possibly the world. I think it's world renowned. Stoke-on-Trent has that reputation. Just the names: Wedgwood, Royal Doulton, Minton, Port Merion. They're global brands, and they were the pinnacle of ceramic production. For hundreds of years. So I started the MA and I treated it very much as a sort of fine art approach, more than a sort of design approach. So my work was quite expressive, sculptural. I sort of went into dust pressing. So I was using industrial techniques, collaging, dust press, colored tiles onto wall pieces. I started casting toys, finding small toys that are quite light. And part of the course was mold making. So, I started making 2 and 3 part molds of small toys, and I started introducing cast toys in Perrion, coloured earthenware bodies, and sort of mounting them on a sort of wall piece of dust press tiles, which had sort of collage, different textures and collages on. Strangely enough, my tutors didn't like that at all and tempted to remove me from the course about 3 times, which was unfortunately, or well, fortunately, I'll say, I'm quite stubborn and I just carried on. The threat of being kicked off the course wasn't enough to frighten me from my path. And then the irony is, after 2 years, I got to the end, put my MA show up to display for grading, The Master of Arts courses in the UK are assessed from an external verifier, which meant that the grade was given to me from someone outside of the course, and they gave me the distinction. And the look of shock on my tutors' faces when they announced that they'd given me the distinction in a course of 12 people was absolutely priceless. I thought sort of in they didn't come up and thank me, which maybe they understood trying to throw me off three times was maybe the wrong thing to do. So yeah, I mean that was my education. I then went traveling around the world for 3 years, 3.5 years. Spent some time in Canada, in Toronto. Traveled all through the States. Stayed in San Francisco for a bit, where I met my wife. Then we traveled through Japan, whole of Southeast Asia, not India, Taiwan, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Indonesia, ended up in Australia for 6 months. And the whole time, I was absorbing the sort of the culture, the art, the drawings, the colors, everything around me. And I think traveling is sometimes it's quite subliminal. Everything you look at comes out at a later time. Everything you see, you witness, you absorb it visually and store it somewhere. And I ended up after 3.5 years of having a kind of creative bank of ideas and colors, and that really has fueled probably the last 35 years of what I've been doing, creating.
How did you get from all of those colors and brilliant images that I can imagine you saw on your travels to forming black and white designs?
I hadn't always done black and white, strangely enough. I would say I'm probably known for black and white designs now. It's very much at the forefront of what I do on a daily basis. But there have been times when I've used really bright colors with small decorative pieces. I set my studio up in the 1989 in Stone, Staffordshire, just north of Stoke-on-Trent, sorry, south of Stoke-on-Trent. And I started off slip trailing and using quite brightly colored slips, staining clay, slab building, really bright colors, and making small lidded boxes, really just to get started, just to make money, just to continue. I
Sure.
was doing a bit of teaching as well, part time. But in the late 80s, it was the kind of boom of, and I would say American-led glaze technology. You could buy really intense yellows, reds, bright colors, in these great big sort of hobby pottery warehouses. And I knew about them because my initial introduction to going to the States was to work on summer camps as a ceramics counselor. And I remember working in Pennsylvania in a camp called Summit Camp, It was for what is termed in Britain special needs children. And I got there and I was basically presented with a pottery studio with a kiln, quite a big kiln, and about 10 buckets of rock hard concrete glaze, with no glaze mixer, to kind of refresh them. And the color palette was brown, light brown, dark brown, oatmeal, blue, light blue, dark blue. And I looked at it and almost, it was the most depressing thing I'd ever seen. So I told the camp director, I said, I must go and get some glazes. He said, well, there's a place about 30 miles from here. Here's the budget. You've got quite a bit of money. Just buy some glazes. And I went in. And of course, I'd never seen racks and racks of super bright, intense colors. Really easy just to kind of brush on the outside. The special needs children didn't have to dip anything, didn't have to spray anything. They could brush it on. It was like paint. And I thought, wow, this is quite impressive. Bought huge numbers of these amazing little pots, probably, well, maybe in pints, and proceeded to do the 8 weeks of the summer camp. And the campers absolutely loved the richness of the colors. Most I'm sort of generalizing now, but a lot of children go back to the same camp, from the age of sort of 6, 7 to the age of 14, 15. And some of the campers were just saying, wow, this is amazing. Usually it's blue or brown. And now, I'm making yellow. And it was just, the reaction was fantastic. The first few firings, people were coming down to the pottery cabin and just saying, wow, I can't wait to, when we get to do ceramics. So it got a great reaction. I managed, then I went back the next year. They doubled my wages, which was fantastic. And then the final third year, I went back again. Also, I did play around with them slip casting some molds as well, and hand building. So they would hand build, slip cast, and produce these super colorful things. The parents' reaction was fantastic. They were like, wow, this is not brown or blue. And they took the pieces home to put it alongside on the mantelpiece of all the blue and brown pieces. So that was why, when back in England in 89, I thought, I should be exploiting this new technology. And so I started hand building, mold making, casting pieces up, assembling them in sort of, you could say, anthropomorphic sculptures. They implied a sort of character to they it didn't have a face, they didn't have a nose, eyes, but the angles implied some kind of personality. And I would paint them with bright colors. I started using gold and platinum lusters, silver, blue, mother of pearl, and putting these things together. They were quite one-offs. They were one-offs, and I think my reputation at that time, I couldn't really sell many of these things. People seemed to like them, but a lot of galleries like stability. They like to be able to, have s similar items. If they know their clients, they say, "Oh, well, could you have send more of those things?" You know, they seem to sell. So it became quite sort of formulaic. Later on, I made some mugs, and I put black and white decoration, slip trailing decoration on them, and I had a little sort of very small friendly craft show. And I put them out, and they absolutely flew out. The six mugs sold within, minutes. And I just thought, wow, there's something here. This is a reaction. It took me by surprise. And I thought, there's something in black and white, So I started making a functional range. Now, I trained in Stoke. So my heritage was, and I didn't go the traditional route of maybe being an apprentice to a thrower, working in a pottery, terracotta, garden ware. I was very much influenced by the industry, which is jigger jollying, casting, and then on top of that, I was adding hand building, press molding, sprigs, using a lot of plaster work, which is where my training came from. Just remember that I started in textiles, so I was very new to ceramics. And if there's one way of starting to earn a living, a reasonable living income, is to use industrial techniques. So I built up a functional range, black and white, and started. I did a few trade fairs, galleries loved it. And within about 5 incredibly hard-working years, where I became a workaholic, basically, lived, breathed, 14-hour days, 7 days a week. I managed to get about 30 to 40 galleries,
Wow, that's a lot.
and along with one day's teaching a week at a local college. So, started establishing, myself, and continued that for quite a while. Started doing public shows, selling direct to the public, and which is, they're just fantastic. You cannot not enjoy a public show with a whole bunch of other potters. Potters, ceramicists are some of the finest people on the planet. They're warm, kind, friendly, generous people, and we had clay in common. And when we weren't selling to the public, I'll say the adoring public, who were also feeding back and saying, "Wow, I really like this. I'd like to buy some." Who doesn't like standing there, with the adoring public, praising your skills and then giving you money for it, and then in the evening, partying your socks off with just like-minded and friendly people.
Perfect.
So shows, I've started doing shows. I do about 5 big shows a year, and I find them highly enjoyable. Just such good fun. Traveling around most of Britain, north, southeast, west, different shows, different areas. And it's a good way of selling, good way of getting reaction on new designs, new work. The public are right there, and they're telling you whether they like it or not.
Right, you get immediate feedback, don't you?
Oh yeah, and I think we all really love doing public shows. And I tend to do the larger shows, which are well organized, well advertised. They're quite expensive, But then they have a good advertising budget. They get thousands of people arriving. They're mainly pottery-only shows. So you're preaching to the converted. People know that they're going to get pottery in all of its joyous celebration of different techniques and colors and ideas. You can have 150 potters in a show, and not one single piece of work will look at, anything like someone else's. And that's the beauty of clay and the variations of expression that individuals can make is it's stunning. I sometimes ask people at these shows, "Oh, have you been before?" And I can usually tell they haven't because their eyes are wide open and they're looking around and they cannot believe the diversity and selection of work that's facing them. They won't like it, everything at the show, but it's the creativity and imagination of the potters just is pouring out
It's a beautiful thing.
into their memory, and they come back, and they enjoy it, and it's a great way to sell. I've stopped doing galleries after COVID, after the epidemic. COVID, for I think for many people, was a very strange time. All the galleries closed in England. People, and so all the orders dried up. So I thought I'd be bankrupt very rapidly, but I got my web shop sorted out and really tightened it all up. And I ended up having one of my best financial years in like 6 years. It kind of made me realize that I didn't have to rely on the gallery system and that I could actually sell direct from an online shop and do public shows.
I think a lot of people are finding that they can make a living that way, whereas the, I'll call it the older system of always relying on galleries is going by the wayside a little bit for some people like yourself. You know, Mark, I was listening to you here talk about this journey that you've been on and your work, and I wondered what it is that's inspiring you these days. What's getting you out of bed in the morning with clay?
I think I've got lots of different strands to my work. I probably divide it up into like, different sort of sections. I like making functional ware, which is a kind of production. You make 20 mugs, 30 mugs. I like the sort of slightly meditative, repetitive element of that. Just getting up, making some mugs, and maybe preparing for a show. Teapots, bowls, jugs, platters, and generally functional ware sells. It sells much quicker than, fine art pieces. And what the so that's I like that steady day to day, pack the kiln, unpack the kiln, glaze, dip everything, put it back in the kiln. There is an element of pleasure from repeatability, and producing fine work that is monetarily accessible to the public. A mug's not going to break the bank. It probably my mugs are a bit more expensive than something you buy, in a big store. But it's handmade, and people appreciate it. Then the next thing is the sculptures. The sculptures are, well, I can't say non-functional because I'd like to think humor and amusement and entertainment is actually a function of human life. That they can look at my sculptures and see them as an object, of an art object that has a suggested fake functionalism. Some of my sculptures, I use lots of toys. I've got quite a few sculptures where I've made molds of toy trumpets, and I have a sort of slab built base, and then pieces that fit on top. I attach slip cast clay trumpets to those shapes. They can be spherical, slab built, square, usually on legs. You could align them to the tradition of Staffordshire flatbacks. Staffordshire flatbacks were front facing whimsies that were placed on people's mantelpieces, and they were meant to amuse, and some of them had sort of mildly naughty political meaning, of the day. But I like to think that my sculptures are a little like that. They're intended to make you happy, brighten your day, maybe question you a little bit. What is this thing I'm looking at? It looks like it might be functional, but it isn't. And I like that. I like the fact it potentially it appears to be functional, but isn't. And probably third section is my decoration. So I'm known for slip trailing, which it generally appears on the functional ware, mugs, bowls, etc. But also use paper stencils. And my influences for those shapes are from the natural world. When I grew up, I would look into old biology books and there'd be an image of an amoeba. And those sort of amorphous shapes, I kind of use those in my work. But also like things like 1950s images of atomic structure, planets, UFOs. I basically grew up in the 60s, so I'm kind of influenced by those science fiction-y images of the Jetsons and Lost in Space, and the shape of Robbie the Robot. They're all kind of fed into my sort of shape library, I suppose you could say. And then using those shapes and joining them together, applying this sort of very contrasty black and white decoration. And I try and get a nice balance between spiky shapes and soft, rounded shapes. It's quite busy, quite dynamic. There's a lot of movement in the shapes that I cut out of paper and apply to the surface of the clay. Then I obviously brush the black slip over the paper, peel it off, and it's a paper resist.
There's a real playful quality to your work, in all your
Absolutely.
work, even your functional work, that has the slip trailing on it, has an energy to it, a playfulness to all of it.
You've absolutely got that. I slip trail very quickly, so my line work has a speed to it. To me, slip trailing is just a form of drawing, a draftsmanship, onto the surface of the clay. And I decorate with real speed. My lines have energy due to the fact they've been done very quickly, which you could sort of compare to, say, American abstract expressionist painters. Is it Franz Kline? The big brushstroke canvases, just a big brush, big pot of paint, giant white canvas, three brushstrokes. I mean, to me, that's the energy of those lines is so obvious because of the nature of the action of a painting or the action of the way I slip trail. The lines have energy because I put energy into those lines. I use dots, and my influences obviously come from, say, Australian Aboriginal art, the sort of coloured mud paintings on bark, the Dreamtime paintings, which involve lots of lines and dots describing territories or journeys, passing knowledge down through generations through visual imagery. And I absorbed that Australian Aboriginal art, and it definitely comes out in my work. I mean, alongside people like Miro, Picasso, South America, pre-Hispanic South American art, all of those decorative methods, I've absorbed them. People like Victor Vassarelli, his sense of pattern, M.C. Escher. I think we all know, if you didn't have an M.C. Escher poster on, in your dorm, when you're a student, alongside, say, Metallica or something poster, it was just one, or Salvador Dali poster. It was M.C. Escher was just one of those universally enjoyed graphic designers, and sophisticated, generally black and white, or obviously shades, monochrome, but very clever, and again, definitely absorbed some of that that visual imagery, I'd say.
And so your work really has been pulling from many cultures around the world. And it's got this energy that we talked about, this sense of freedom. And you've stuck mostly to a black and white surface, but you also have some colors in there, some lusters and some other colors. Can you tell us a bit about how you think about adding some of these other colors?
Again, probably going back to my training in Stoke-on-Trent, for gold and platinum have been used in industrial pottery for many, many years. And it was mainly to add value. So if you had a tea set from Wedgwood, if you put a nice little gold band on the rim or a dash of gold on the handle, it made it special. It raised it above the pottery that didn't have gold. True, it's another firing. You have to put it back in the kiln. You have to get a paintress. A painter would have to paint the handle, paint the rim. They became incredibly skilled. I've seen in Stoke-on-Trent Many years ago, I would see people, mainly the paintresses were mainly women in the industry. They would tap center a mug, a bone china mug on a whirler, and they would put a gold rim, they would brush the gold rim and the handle within seconds, and they'd put it back in the pile of 50 mugs on a ware board. And it was just incredible to watch. So I think it's understood that lusters add something special. It's a bit of bling, gold's universally for millennia has been the symbol of value. Added value. Jewelry is made in gold and platinum, and it's seen as something precious. I tend to overuse it deliberately. I mean, some of my pieces just have so much gold and platinum on, and I'm quite aware of this. People say, "Wow, wow, there's so much gold." It's sort of deliberate in a way, I suppose. Maybe I'm trying to be flippant by overusing it, but it does add a kind of third level of reflective qualities of a ceramic piece. So you've got a most of my work is earthenware. It's quite shiny. I use stains, black stain, and then the if you put gold and platinum luster on a very shiny glaze, it comes out like a mirror. I also really love that quality that it's a reflective surface. So the glaze reflects light. And the gold and platinum luster is a mirror. It reflects the person viewing the piece. And I just love that juxtaposition of levels of reflectivity to a ceramic piece.
Now that sounds very serious, but I bet you there's a playfulness in there that you've got going.
I'm not very, I might have sounded serious so far, but all my work, and you said earlier on, and I totally agree with you, it's playful. Describing work in words, my work in words, is far more difficult actually just viewing it. And to be honest, please, after listening to this podcast, just rush to actually have a look at what I do, and you'll be far more amused by the visuals of it than my words. But yeah, it's I would my work is intended to improve people's lives, to make them happier, to question them in an amusing way. Not it's not a sort of an aggressive questioning, but I'd like to think my work amuses and tries to get some kind of curiosity in the viewer, more describing my sculptures. I just hope people are curious, but if they go away with not really understanding it, I hope that they've gone away from viewing my work with a sort of smile on their face. I mean, that's my job. I'm definitely an optimist, and my aim is to improve people's lives through my work,
Very
without
cool.
doubt.
Yeah, and really, I think your work does produce that feeling in people. They're going to be drawn into it and be interested in it. Well, can you tell our audience like maybe one challenge that you faced in the development of your work?
No. I suppose that's a simple answer. I don't see. Somehow, that's quite a loaded word, challenge. It implies a difficulty in some ways, and I think I've my whole kind of creative life as a ceramic artist, I'm quite kind of slow. If I have a technique which doesn't quite work, then I'll just keep working. I keep working at it and finally come to some kind of resolution, which I'm pleased with. I suppose, yeah, challenge. I mean, I think I tend to, personally, I think I tend to keep s ideas and I store them. And there's long-term memory ideas, which might be 10 years, medium sort of ideas that are in medium-term memory, and then there's ideas that I want to make sort of in next week or a month's time. And I've found over 35 years that occasionally the long-term memory ideas just then push into medium, and then I want to make them next week. So creativity for me is all about ideas. And then bringing those ideas out when they're ready, when they're cooked, when they're mature and they're ready to come out into the world. And I'm willing to make the effort to make that happen. So, yeah, I haven't, to be honest, I don't think I've, oh, well, I mean, I think every potter, every ceramic artist, they blow something up, it cracks. I've never seen that as a mistake or a failure. I just see it as as something I don't want to repeat, and I'll find another way of going around it.
It sounds like to me though, when you've encountered a problem, a crack or something, or an idea that isn't quite satisfactory to you, that you have been persistent. And it seems like to me that's your way of overcoming a challenge, if we think of it in that word, has been to be persistent, to stick with it, to keep working at it until you're able to get to the end that you're looking for.
Absolutely. I bet if I gave you the title of a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, I'm sure you're a similar age to me. I don't know. You probably read that. But the philosophy was the guy wants to fix his motorbike. I mean, it's obviously got all sorts of philosophy wrapped up in the book. But one thing I took away from it is that if you have thinking about resolving a problem is as important as actually resolving the problem. And the thinking will help you in the physical resolving of an issue. So I think I'm a bit of a thinker. I try and if I see that the clay is cracked or see that something's happened to it, then before I even try and fix it, in a sense, I could spend a very long time thinking about what went wrong and how to progress. And of course, that thinking doesn't actually come out into the real world. It doesn't have a physical presence
Yeah, no, I
until
I understand
You actually
completely.
apply it. When you apply that thinking to resolving a problem in ceramics and it works, then like I say, the thinking is as important as the resolution. So.
I'm wondering if you could think about a young ceramic artist, or maybe I should say new ceramic artist, and you're giving that person some advice about how to move forward in their career with clay. What advice would you give a person? What's some wisdom that you've acquired that you'd like to share?
Well, I gave a demo just this weekend gone to the Southern Ceramics Group, which is just southwest of London. Lovely group. They got 200 members. Wonderful, really lovely group. And part of my demo was I've got a PowerPoint slide, and I say, always be yourself. Unless you can be Batman, and then be Batman. And people were kind of curious, what's that actually mean? And then, but actually, I said, well, actually, I'm not Batman, but I'm going to be myself. And I think I've always tried to find my own path of I every ceramic artist is influenced by what's around them, but it's the way you interpret that. I don't wanna, you do see work which is very similar to other people's work. And it will always happen. But I see creativity as ideas, and even those ideas are influenced by my surroundings and other people's work. I think those ideas have got to find their own way in a sort of honest, internalized method of thinking. And I think I've always tried to do that. I've always tried to work, I suppose, in a kind of slightly influenced but solitary way. So, building on my style, the style I've created, the designs I've created, and just keep moving them on a little bit, changing them. I mean, maybe I shouldn't tell this story. Okay, I might anyway. All right. Here we go.
Go for it.
So I visited a wood firing potter's house, and on the shelves, a well-known wood firing potter's house, and stayed overnight. And in the kitchen, there were shelves and shelves of wood-fired ceramics. There were 50 mugs. 30 jugs. It was almost sort of floor to ceiling shelving of wood fired, that lovely orangey, rich wood fired stoneware. And I said to the well-known potter, I said, wow, it must be so good to have your work on display. I didn't know much about wood firing then. And he looked at me and just said, you realize there's 70 different makers on those shelves. I didn't. I really didn't. To me, it looked all the same. Now, that was when I was much younger and far more naive. I've learned a lot since that time. But I'd like to think that I strive for some kind of individuality, but not for its own sake. I don't want to be seen as, my work as being very individual and different purely for that reason. It's got to come from a certain honesty from within. And that's really happened over 35 years. My ideas come out, I think, in an honest sort of way, and I try not, even though, I mean, my own personal ceramics collection probably has 100 different makers in every technique that you could imagine in ceramics. And I love that diversity. I worship that diversity of expression that clay can give, and all the different firings, gas, oil, electric, raku. But for myself, I want to stay true to some kind of momentum that I've created over 35 years, and into the future as well. I want to kind of maintain that, and share it as well. I mean, I've been giving lots of demos recently to pottery groups, and I feel I'm at a certain time in my life where I want to share, absolutely share everything I've learned. So, share all of my techniques. I have no trouble. I'm not secretive in that way. I would tell anyone how I create my work, because it will always be different.
Absolutely. And
Does that make
that makes
sense?
perfect sense. And
Okay.
I want to thank you for sharing your ideas with
Mm.
us here today. You've shared some really interesting ideas about how to be yourself, as you talked about with your advice for a new person, and to be really true to your internal ideas and the generation of those things, and to let them nurture themselves and to be able to work that into the clay itself. So thank you so much for being here today. I'm sure everybody who's going to listen to this will love it. And of course, we will put notification of your website and all that stuff on the show notes so people can find the opportunity to go and see your beautiful work.
Can I do a very quick plug?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hopefully you'll edit out some of my waffle and keep this one in. But there are many really bad slip trailers out there that splatter and are n made mainly from a hard rubber ball, which you squeeze. About 15 years ago, I designed my own slip trailer, and for 11 years I used it. It works for me. Many friends said you should sell that, and it took me 11 years to finally, in 2017, I launched the Mark Daly slip trailer, and I've sold now to 23 countries around the world, and it's exactly the same as the slip trailer I use every day to decorate, and it's been cathartic, to say the least, that I got an order from South, where was it? South America, Argentina. I got an order from Argentina, and I realized a potter in Argentina bought my slip trailer. And how the hell did they find out about it? Well, obviously the internet, social media, but just a mild plug. If you want a really good slip trailer, then sliptrailer.com. Have
I
a
will.
read the reviews. Read the reviews of all the potters that have used it before you go anywhere near the shop, because I make them myself. Most people that sell slip trailers never use them. They're just a big shop and they sell slip trailers. They don't know what they're like. I suppose you could say that I've field tested mine for like 20 years, so I know it works.
Awesome. We will
There you
put that
go.
up on the website as well to make sure people can
Okay.
find that. And
Yeah.
I hope people do, because having the right tool is very important. Not that we need a lot of tools, but when you need a tool, you want to use the right one.
Well, in answer to that, potters are tool makers. We ceramic artists, tool makers, any creative person, We make tools to make our method of working easier, sh mainly shortcuts, or just to make it fundamentally more enjoyable. So tool making is a vital part of ceramics, I think.
Thank you, Mark. Really appreciate you being here today.
That went so quickly.
Yeah,
Wow, it's a whole hour. I can waffle on for you could make it 2 hours if you want.
no, that's good. Thank you so much. I really appreciated you being here today, and I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll
Yeah,
send
it's
you the
been
links
great.
once we're ready to go.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.